Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, December 16th edition of Writers on Writing. We're on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and also available via podcast. More about that during the second half of the show. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. As for this hour, I'll be talking to two guests. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with debut novelist Sandria Fay, author of Mourner's Bench. But first up, novelist Bruce Bauman. Bruce is the author of the novel And the Word Was. Among his awards are a COLA, City of Los Angeles Fellowship in Literature, a Durfee Foundation grant, and a UNESCO Ashburg Fellowship. His work has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, Salon, BOM, Book Forum, and numerous anthologies and literary magazines. Bruce is an instructor in the CalArts MFA Writing Program and Critical Studies Department, and has been senior editor of Black Clock Literary Magazine since its inception in 2003. His new novel is Broken Sleep, published by Other Press, and I'm so pleased to welcome him to the show. Hi there, Bruce.
Hello, Nicole. So, glad to be here.
Let's start off by having you introduce your book, Broken Sleep, to us. Would you tell us what it's about?
It's called a rock and roll novel, an art novel, a family novel. It's about a family, the Savant family. And it begins with Salome Savant, who's the matriarch of the family, and a world-famous artist who's also been institutionalized because she has severe emotional problems. But the act that gets the novel going is when Moses, whose last name is not the same as hers, discovers that he, unfortunately, has a very vicious form of cancer, and he needs a bone marrow transplant. And that starts off the action where he goes in search of his mother, who he has never met, and also his father, who he has never met. He was adopted at birth, which he didn't know for most of his life. And then it goes through the next, it goes back in time as early as the 40s and goes into the future and follows Moses as he discovers that Alchemy Savant, who's the lead singer of the Insatiables rock band, the most famous rock band in the world starting in the 90s, is his half-brother. So I think that pretty much sums it up.
When you began working on the novel, did it start with that problem that Moses finds out he has leukemia, or where did the novel start for you?
I actually had two stories in mind. One was about the Insatiables, a rock band. I wanted to follow that and see the cultural history. And I had another story about someone who did not know his past and got very sick. And for a while I struggled on how to tell each of those stories, and I can't tell you when or how it hit me they should be put together. And the second that happened, that Moses and Alchemy were half-brothers, the novel just started rolling from there. I always knew from early on that the story of the Insatiables would be told not by Alchemy, but by the bass player in the band, who was born Ricky McFinn and who is renamed Ambitious Mindswallow.
I love the names, and I'm going to come back to that.
Okay.
But in the book, there's a lot of art. So you mentioned the musicians, and so we get lyrics in the book and a long discography of the work by the Insatiables in the back. And also, we have art. And so starting with the performance art piece, Art is Dead, in the beginning, and then others. So I'm wondering, did you ever feel overburdened by these characters you've created who are so creative that you had to, you know, make art upon art?
No, that was actually so much fun because I don't have any talent as a visual artist, and I can't sing a lick, but I love art and I love music, so it gave me the chance through the characters who pretty much took on personalities of their own and spoke to me and told me what their art was to use that side of myself without ever actually having to make a piece of art or write a piece of music. The lyrics, you know, that's more in my wheelhouse of it's writing, So it was just, no, I never felt overburdened. As a matter of fact, I was so enthused every time I got an idea for a new song or a new art performance. It was great. I had a tremendous time writing the book.
Would you read to us from the book?
Sure. I'm going to read an early passage from it's the chapters that are written in third person and are called the Moses Chronicles. And this is when Moses first learns or begins to learn of his heritage. Your ghost is alive. Through the phone, Moses could practically feel Sedona Cherry's self-congratulatory pat on the back as she breathlessly relayed her discovery. Moses sighed. She continued, old and in failing health, but alive. Not only is your father still kicking, he owns a condo exactly 3.6 miles from your door. 40 years of intractable angst and 3,000 therapeutic miles later, and he ends up in spyglass distance from my home, Moses thought. What a cosmic joke. West on Venice, north on Ocean, all the way to, hey, Ms. Cherry, stop. How Moses wished his father had been dead until he again remembered that he needed him alive. Professor, there's more. Professor? He hadn't told Cherry that he was a professor of American history in the irrelevant department in the Southern California College of Art and Music, a.k.a. SCAM, located in Pasadena. Okay, go ahead, slowly, though. He also has a place in Rio, not sure of that address, where it seems he spends most of his time. As of last night, he was here, in Los Angeles. According to all official records, Hannah is your birth mother. Are you positive she is not your mother? Nothing about Moses' past made sense anymore. Malcolm Toomer had slept with his mom. Well, they were married, and Moses was born on December 8, 1958, and for 40 years he had believed Hannah had given birth to him. Unfortunately, Miss Cherry, I'm sure. Well, if she doesn't know who your actual mother is, I don't think there's anyone left alive who can help except your father. This father had stuck around for 2 years after Moses' birth before evaporating into the suburban air. Except for a failed search at the age of 17, where certain scents before going dead had hinted toward South America as his ultimate landing place, Moses remained unknowing of where Malcolm lived or if he was even still alive. Cherry waited on the other end of the phone for an answer as Moses began to imagine for the umpteenth time in another of what he termed his daymares, a new version of his father's journey, this time from New York to Los Angeles, destination due overland. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you. That was Bruce Bauman reading from his new novel, Broken Sleep. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Now, this passage is a serious one, and yet there's still humor in it, with SCAM being the university where he teaches. And so, and the novel's very funny. So I'm curious about what role humor plays for you as you're writing. Is that something that comes out in the first draft?
I hope so. I mean, humor is essential to me in my life, so I hope it comes out in my writing. And yes, it was in the first draft. A lot of times it was a lot of the, should I say, sillier puns got excised from the novel. But from the beginning, I'd hoped that you know, the humor goes from sort of deeply ironic, almost tragic, from the first chapter with Salome and Art is Dead, to kind of silly sometimes with Mind Swallow, who also can be serious. And sort of tragedy, and there's tragedy, I think, in this, has to be balanced with comedy. This may sound a little bit too much, but I am a big believer that in Aristotle's definition of tragedy, which is irony and empathy, and you need both of those to make a formidable piece of art. So I'm hoping both are in there.
And the wordplay is something we find throughout in the names, and in particular the rock band and song
right.
sections. But so you have fun with words, and you invented a term called soul smell. and there's some, I think, French and German and a little Latin sprinkled in the pages. And so a random question, but do you speak a foreign language?
French very badly. But, you know, I spent a bunch of time in Europe, so I picked up a lot of phrases and I did a lot of research. So my understanding of French is okay. My speaking, I speak it with a really bad Queen's accent. And I only speak in one tense, whether it's past or future. So, but I know enough to use it, you know, in the book, and I have people check me out also to make sure it's right.
Does that come in your language? Do you, like, when you're in your writing, rather? So if you're, say, stuck, do you ever, does your brain shift over into, you know, that zone to play around, or?
With not the foreign languages. I mean, the characters that do use it, the characters are very much alive to me, so it's almost automatic that they would speak with that. And the you know, the punning names, they come from my dreams to working very hard on them. Some of them are anagrams, which as well as puns, like the character of Laban Lively is an anagram of Evilly Banal, which comes from Hannah Arendt, and he's a spy. That one I worked really hard on. Say, Absurda Nightingale, that came to me in a dream. So it's a wild mix that I don't fully understand, and I'm glad I don't understand it fully. It may mess me up if I did.
And it's clear that the characters are practically alive for you, because in terms of the dialogue, it's comfortable and realistic, and each character has a distinct speaking style. Is writing dialogue something that comes easy for you?
I would say that anything comes easy, but it's once the characters come alive, they just speak, and you can feel when it's right and when it's not. So Mindswall, like I said, I had him from the beginning. I softened up his language, so it was more comprehensible at first when I wrote it. It was really heavy Queens, and it was written that unless you came from Queens, you could barely understand his syntax, at least the Queens where I grew up. So I changed that so it's easy. But the dialogue, yeah, it feels right, and, you know, you get one or two sentences, and then that goes for the rest of the time. And when it feels off, I read everything I do aloud, and I can hear it. I said, no, you know, Salome wouldn't say that, or Moses wouldn't speak that way. So, you know, it's very good to hear your own work. And then I put it up on the walls of my studio so I can really look at it and read it and feel it if it's right. So it's also really fun to hear them speaking and how they would go at each other or compliment each other. It's just, you know, a lot of it's fun. I like to tell my students, if you're not having fun, it's too hard to do this. So I had a, you know, like I said, it was great fun for me to hear them speak.
With regard to reading out loud, did you say you read the dialogue scenes out loud, or do you read the whole?
I read the whole book, you know, never straight through, but as I've written passages, and when I think I've got it right, I read it aloud. To see, I don't read, you know, I rewrote the book between 8 and 10 times every chapter, so I don't read every time aloud, but the whole book has been read aloud by me over the period of 8 years.
Did you have a favorite character?
That changes by the day, and you know, that sometimes I have a favorite character who I'm really in love with, and there are days when the characters are not making me happy, so I don't like them. But I feel this is very important. I love all my characters, even the ones who are kind of evil, because I feel like if I don't love my characters, then they're not going to come through truthfully to the reader, and they will feel a falseness. There were times, especially with Mind Swallow, where he did some really, really awful things. And that was very hard for me to write, because I do like him, but he has some pretty despicable characteristics at times. So when I'm writing that, I love him, but I also hate him.
I'm talking to Bruce Bauman. His new novel is Broken Sleep. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine. And with regard to Salome, I mentioned earlier this phrase, soul smells, and that's a term for what she can perceive. And an example is that she says, he reeked of little shards of rancid mayonnaise-y potatoes marinated in mothballs. So I'm wondering, when I was thinking about the craft part of this, what came first for you as a writer, the ability to dissect smells like that, or the character trait of Salome's, which then, you know, forced you to step up your smell descriptions?
The character trait of Salome's came first, that she had some otherworldly sense of people. And, you know, because she was a visual artist, I wanted it to be something other than visual, but to maximize the language visually, so you could see those shards and other people's smells, but also get a sensation of the smell off the page. I think it's really important for all characters to give a sense that you can see how they walk and feel them and hear them and hear their voices, and probably the hardest is to maybe smell them and to use all our senses. So since she has a heightened sense of all senses, that came the best and came the easiest, rather, when I got the soul smell. And it helped me define the character she was talking about as well. So it was another really fun thing to play with. And also, in my research, I had read that the first of our senses that actually is most acute is smell. It's not sight. It's not sound. So that would make sense for her as well.
Yeah, and yet it's often overlooked in literature, I think. And in terms of endeavoring to describe smells to that level, was it like a muscle? Did you have to work at it? Or how did you, develop that part of it?
I wouldn't say it was like a muscle. This is so defies reason in a sense. But when I was writing it, and it would come to me that this person has a soul smell, it just came out. Like I said, the creative process for me is a mix of unconscious and consciousness, and the unconscious part created the soul smells, and then the conscious part is getting the phrasing exactly right once I had the essence of the smell. And that's the inexplicable part to me. I wish I knew where some of it came from sometimes, but other times I'm just glad that it shows up.
I'm talking to Bruce Bauman. His new novel is Broken Sleep. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And this book is vast from its time frame of 80 years and its many characters, with four of them being point of view, and its well-developed side characters. So at the beginning, you talked about having these two separate stories that came together for this novel. How did you then kind of scrap those as they were and just start over on page one? Or I'm just interested in the drafting process some more.
Yes, I did. And once I decided that process, I mean, I don't outline or anything, but I have notebooks or notes for things, and that's what I kept. And then the process then was which character should begin the novel and how does it go from there. And there were many experiments beginning with either Moses or beginning with Salome. And at one point I even had the granddaughter Persephone beginning it telling the story, and it just many, many rewrites till suddenly I said Salome is the matriarch. It has to begin with her. Plus, she would be really unhappy if she didn't begin this story because she's kind of a narcissist. And it just goes from there, and then the rewriting and the ordering of the chapters. At times I would have a file of pages of just Moses, just Salome, just Mind Swallow, just the minor characters, and then they would integrate. It's, as things happen, as a story tells itself, I discovered new things and then would have to go back and rewrite sometimes. I don't want to give away too much, but in, I'd say, at least 4 years into the process, I had decided Moses would never meet his father. And then a couple of my readers, one of them is Alan Peacock, and said, you have to have him meet. And that changed quite a lot. I had to go rewrite from before and rewrite some chapters ahead. So the process is constantly evolving as the characters evolve.
And I was interested in this visual component to your dialogue where you actually put it on the walls. Did you use the visual component for structuring too and ordering the chapters? Did you have a story?
Yes. When I put them on the walls, at one point it's just all printed stuff. And other points I color code them. So this is a Moses chapter. Say that would be in blue. A Salome would be in red. A Mind Swallow would be in black. And I would print them out in those different colors so I could see the flow of the different chapters on the walls. So you wouldn't go too many Moses or too many this without it. So there would be the integration and the flow of the characters. And, you know, I picked the colors by what I thought they would want their colors to be. Like in the book, there's a Salome Savant red, so she had to be red, kind of thing. So, yeah, everything was color-coded. And a couple of minor characters were either purple or orange. So I like to be able to see everything that way, too. And it's easy to move around on the walls, even though it's 600 pages.
Well, Bruce, we're drawing down on our time, but before we let you go, do you have any writing advice to share?
Writing advice. I've given a lot. For fiction, and this is somewhat controversial, I say never write an outline. Let your characters take you where they're going. Don't have predetermined ideas of how your story is going to end. And I am a big believer in writing or trying to write or spending at least an hour a day with your book while you're doing it. Waiting for the muse, if I was waiting for the muse, my books would never get written because I'm easily diverted to do other things. So I believe in that. And the most important thing any writer can do is read great books. I've read thousands of books in my life, and that's the best teacher in the world, I think.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I really love programs that are about literature. So thank you. Those are great questions, too.
That was Bruce Bauman. His new novel is Broken Sleep, published by Other Press. During the second part of the show, Sandaria Fay, author of the book Mourner's Bench, will be here. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast and also available on Stitcher. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with novelist Bruce Bauman. Next up, I'll be speaking with author Sandaria Fay. Sandaria's work has appeared in various literary journals and in ARSNC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Arkansas. Sandaria is a co-founder and fellow at Kimbelio Center for Fiction. She is a recipient of awards, residencies, and fellowships from Hurst and Wright Writers Conference, Eckerd College's Writers in Paradise Conference, Kalalu Writers Workshop, Vermont Writers Studio, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and Martha's Vineyard Writers Residency. Sandaria is also a PhD candidate in the School of Arts and Humanities at the University of Texas at Dallas. She received an MFA in creative writing from Arizona State University. Her new novel is Mourner's Bench. It's published by University of Arkansas Press, and I'm so pleased to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Sandaria.
Hi, Nicole. How are you?
Doing great. So let's start off by having you tell us about your book. Would you introduce the story to us?
Yes, I will, and thank you for having me. I'm excited about this, especially one of my professors is there at the University of Irvine, Ron Carson. So I wanted to say hello to him if he's listening. But Mourner's Bench is a coming-of-age story. It's set in a small town in the Arkansas Delta, and it's set during the height of the Civil Rights Movement. 8-year-old Sarah Jones is the narrator and reporter for her family, 4 generations of women, including herself. The reader will have the opportunity to see through Sarah's eyes how the family navigates the terrain of race, gender, religion, and generations of oppression.
And let's go to 8-year-old Sarah. And I wanted to hear more about having a child narrator. So in some sense, it's frowned upon, but there are other examples of it in like Emma Donoghue's Room or Jonathan Safran Foer's Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. And so I'm curious about your finding the narrator for your story. What was the, selection process like?
I know that probably other writers go through different craft options to find the narrator who should tell this story. But I knew right away it should be Sarah. Her voice was clear in my head. And over the years, because it took me a long time to get this to finish writing this novel, I tried different options. I tried to tell it from the point of view of the mother, and I also the point of view of the uncle in the book, who I thought would be a different point of view to get it from his point of view, since he had changed over and become a member of the Nation of Islam. But it was clearly, whatever I tried just didn't work. The voice of Sarah came across very clearly, and her character was just adamant about being the person to tell this story.
And when you were first writing the novel, with the very first thing, did it start with the setting or with the character of Sarah, or was it something else?
It started with Sarah's character. I started with Sarah and her best friend, Malika. I wrote the first piece, and I think it's about page 253 now, but it was a writing prompt that said, write a story that you'd heard all of your life, but you're not unsure of whether it's true or not, or something to that effect. And so that was the first time I heard Sarah's voice. And it was very clear then, and they were the section that I wrote was she and Malika trying to get this most difficult woman to register to vote.
Would you read to us from your book?
Yes, I'll be happy to. The section, the excerpt that I'm going to read is from chapter 14, and I'll just set it up just a little bit. The government has enacted the Freedom of Choice Act, which is in this town meant that a number of the students from the all-colored school would be attending the all-white school. And this caused so much conflict and between the students that their teacher, Sarah's teacher, assigned them to do a family tree. And so where I'm going to start reading from is when Sarah is in front of the class presenting her family tree.
Okay.
4 generations of women live in Sarah's house, Miss Brady said. She pointed to the sketch of my family tree leaning beside the blackboard, right under the calendar we'd made that read 4th grade class, October 1964. I stood on one side of my poster and she on the other side, pointing at each brown branch and green leaf. Sarah, will you tell us the person you have listed on each branch of your tree? She said. Yes, ma'am. I pointed with the ruler. On the first branch is Granny, my great-grandmother. Her real name is Pearlie Hopkins. The next leaf is my grandmother, Moselle White. We call her Madea. I left the leaf blank where Esther's name should have been and pointed to the next branch. The next leaf is for me, Sarah Jones. Before I could finish, hands flew up in the air. Almost every student, a few of them stood up, including Malika. Come down, class. Take your seat. You will have your turn, Miss Brady said. I wasn't expecting them to act that way. Malika raised her arm up and down as if she had to go to the restroom in a hurry. Miss Brady pointed to her first. Why didn't you include your mama's name? She said. Miss Brady looked at me. She seemed as curious more curious than Malika. I stared at Malika, daring her to take it back, and I gave the same stare to the rest of the class. Malika held her ground and dared me right back. "Sarah?" Miss Brady asked. "My mama don't live in the house with us no more, but she's still alive." I rolled my eyes at Malika. "That ain't good enough. That ain't a good enough answer, is it, Miss Brady?" Malika said. "It's all I got, so leave me alone," I said. I knew she wouldn't stop till she got the whole class stirred up. She'd been that way ever since we got our double promotion from the first to the third grade, always trying to prove who was the smartest, and seemed to like it better when she had witnesses. The principals, teachers, and everyone had tried to convince Granny to let me skip the first grade altogether, but she turned them down. But after the next year, she went ahead and let me skip anyway. Granny blamed Miss Tucker and Uncle Robert for teaching me way too much. Malika asked me question after question. She knew the answers. We talked it over. She tried to goad me. I wasn't falling for it, but it became way too much for me when the other students got in on it too, and she should have backed down. "She told you," a boy from the other side of town said. "Leave her alone," he laughed. "Ooh," some of the other students said. Miss Brady let them carry on without saying a word. "She can't do that, can she, Miss Brady?" Malika said. "No, she can't. How can that be? It's as if she ain't got no mama. How can that be?" another boy said. "She knows her mom and daddy, who her mom and daddy is," a girl yelled. "Make her write it on the tree, Miss Brady." "My family ain't nobody's business in here," I said. Miss Brady, frozen in place, pointed at the leaf. "She mad at her mama. That's why she left it off," a girl from the church said. "She mad because her mama wouldn't let her get baptized, and she peed on herself." Miss Brady finally clapped her hands several times, bringing most of the class to order. "Sit," she said with so much conviction, I sat down in her chair. "Calm down, class. I'm sure Sarah has her reasons for not completing the assignment, but regardless, it doesn't give you a reason to ridicule her." She took down my board and looked at me empathetically. Do you understand, class?" We bowed our heads. "She can't win now, can she, Miss Brady?" Malika said. My chest lowered itself somewhere down near my feet, and shame spread all over me like chicken pox. Why did Miss Brady assign us that stupid family tree anyway? Malika's hand went up again. "Leave it alone," I said. "Yes," Miss Brady said. "I don't want that stupid rosebud. You can have it. I don't want to be your friend anymore," I said. "You infiltrator." I'd gotten the word from Rutherford, and it was mean. And Malika knew I left Esther off the family tree on purpose. She knew I was the only one in class who had two great-grandmothers living. I didn't have to write Esther's name for her to count. The whole class looked at me as if I'd cussed when I used the word infiltrator. I walked out of the class, leaving all my belongings. Rutherford would have got a kick out of what I'd said, and I said it cold like he'd heard him say it before, too. Miss Brady came out after me, and I ran. When I got to the corner, I looked both ways and knew I had no place to go where I wouldn't be in trouble. Kids weren't allowed to get mad, to have an opinion about their life. All I could do was what I was told to do, and I didn't, and it caused me to lose my friend, do bad work in class, and get in trouble. So I went to the hall, where maybe nobody would notice me. That evening at the hall, Malika tapped me on the shoulder. "Sorry, Sarah," she said. "Sorry for the whole thing." She picked up my belongings after class and brought them down to the hall with her. "Sometimes you don't know when to quit," I said. "I promise I won't ever do it again. You're my best friend, Sarah." I tapped her shoulder and said, "Tag," and took off running to the backyard. "You better not do it again, and I'm getting you back, too." It wasn't ever that bad before or after between us. But we kept competing with each other. Even later in the semester, when we left our regular class and moved into the gym for our special get ready to go to the white school one.
Thank you. That was Sandria Fay reading from her debut novel, Mourner's Bench. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Now, this story, of course, is set in the 1960s, and I'm wondering about research. There are a lot of historical details here and cultural ones and period details. Like, for instance, there was this line that I liked. Esther didn't seem like the same person as she talked back and forth to the civil rights workers and the neighbors. She acted as if she were the lead turner in a double dutch contest and Mrs. Carey was holding the other end. And Mrs. Carey is a student nonviolent coordinating committee organizer. So anyways, how did you research the time period?
The one good thing that happens is what people, what I've been instructed to do is write about what you know. So the one thing that I know very well is the Arkansas Delta because I grew up there. And but Miss Carey, people like Miss Carey, who appears in the book, Mr. Stitt, George Stitt, Miss Daisy Bates, Miss Carey Dilworth is her name. They were all activists all their lives. Miss Carey and Mr. Stitt were board members for the Southern Tenants Farmers Union. But by the time I came along, they were just older people who lived in the town where I grew up. Miss Daisy Bates lived across the street from my aunt, who was a hairdresser. So this is how I knew those women. But when I started to do my research, I realized, like, wow, I know them. So instead of being able to make them heroes of the movement, I was able to write about them as people, as they probably were then, just were normal people as they were then. But the other research was very difficult because some of the freedom centers and throughout the Delta had been burned down, so there wasn't any records left, no pictures left, just very few things that were left. So finding research was very challenging, like finding a needle in a haystack. So I was very happy whenever I would find something that I could, especially it was something I could use in the novel.
And did you conduct interviews as well?
I tried. I tried to conduct interviews, and there was a scholar before me who had tried to conduct interviews, and he actually let me listen to his tapes. And I knew the people that he had interviewed, so I thought, oh, this would be much easier for me. So say, for instance, I would ask a woman. Some of the people were already passed on, but my mother was an activist during that time, and I would ask her about her role. And she said, well, why did you do it? We did what we had to do. So everything was, like, very general. If you got a full sentence at all, you were doing great. So I wasn't it was very challenging to do oral interviews with those people. And what I came to realize, because most of the people that I was trying to interview were women, that my mother and some of the women included that I interviewed carried were embarrassed about their roles in the civil rights movement. People really hadn't, when I started my research, no one had come and talked to them about their role or given them any credit for the work that they had done. And they had stepped outside of their families and their churches and were ostracized. And so that didn't leave them a good feeling or something that they wanted to talk about.
Yeah, frankly, I'm embarrassed to admit this, but the apprehension that the preacher expresses and the way that Sarah has to wrestle with these ideas and Mudea's disapproval, I didn't realize that there was such ambivalence, and I learned a lot reading your book.
I learned a lot through the research because I hate to say this, being an African-American woman, but it wasn't until I thought that in the 60s everybody picked up a picket sign and everybody wanted to integrate and all of that. I didn't know this until I started doing my research and really just investigating that this wasn't something that, and especially in the town that I write about, it wasn't something that they wanted. And people ask me if it was something that people were afraid of. But I think that it's almost like any time people aren't willing to change, even if it's maybe for the best sometimes. They're unsure about that, uncertain about that. And so they wait until the last minute, until they have no other choice before they make a change.
Yeah, that's really interesting because they use that phrase separate but equal. And, you know, as a reader, you know that that would never happen. And they probably knew on some level that it wouldn't happen. But I thought you did just such a great job of showing that it wasn't just fear, although that was sometimes part of it. But it was complicated and you unpacked it with all your different characters and their contributions. And so there are a bunch of strong female characters, as you've talked about, and with each different perspective, again, you get, you know, a different sense of what's going on. And so was having strong female characters at the center of the book an objective of yours, or did they just emerge?
I believe it emerged that way. Sarah was close to her parents, her grandparents especially. She believed that in everything that they said and did. She was a person who liked to be around older people and listen in. And so it just emerged that way. I don't know why. I was asked why there wasn't a strong male character, but it just seemed that it ended up being about women. And I'm very happy that it did, because in many of the books I've read, you don't see the female character as the leader of the civil rights movement.
Yeah, and also at one point I think Esther talks about the female rights movement being even more important or you know, as important, going hand in hand. Could you talk about, so you founded the Kimbelio Center for Fiction. Could you explain what that is?
Yes, I was a co-founder with David Haynes, and it had been talked about for many years in the African-American community, especially like at AWP, at our conferences, we talked about it. And we wanted something that would mimic Kavi Kanem for poets. Actually, we were a little bit jealous of the poets and their presence at AWP. And so David and I talked about it. He went to his department chair about it, and they approved it. And within 1 year, we set up the community for Kimbelio means Swahili, and Swahili means safe haven. So we tried to set up a safe haven for fiction writers of African diaspora and their stories. And so it started in 2013 with the professors were David Haynes, ZZ Packer, Dolan Perkins, and they had 18 fellows. So in its last summer, it's held in Taos, New Mexico, and last summer it's been going since 2013. Each year it grows. I'm very proud of it, and many of the fellows from there, myself included, are publishing their first books.
And what is the website for people who want to look into becoming a fellow?
It is kimbeliofiction.com. And Kimbelio is Kimbilio. And pretty soon they should be accepting applications for the summer retreat. But not only has it been the summer retreat, we've started to have readings. We will have a reading at Esowan during AWP. But there have been readings at the Brooklyn Book Fair, in Houston, in Dallas, so throughout, in Washington, D.C., with fellows and the professors. Matt Johnson was one of the professors 1 year, and I can't remember everyone, but David Haynes and I had no idea when we stepped into this that it would be the wonderful organization that it is.
Mm. And changing gears here as we draw down on our time, I like to ask debut novelists how they got their agent. So could you tell us that story for you?
I don't have an agent. Actually, I am looking for one for my next novel. I had this. My novel came about sort of differently. I had written a piece for this historian, a fiction piece that's in the book Arsenic. It was published by the University of Arkansas Press. At the time, the press didn't publish any nonfiction. I mean, any fiction books. They only published scholarly books and poetry. And so, a few years later, the editor for that Arsenic was at a conference with the director for the University of Arkansas Press, and they talked about my book. At the time, they had published one fiction book. They asked me to give them a call. I did, and they signed me to a contract.
Wow. And you mentioned a second book. How far along are you on that one?
I would say about halfway through. Maybe I have a draft, but I write a very messy draft. And so I'm pretty far along on that one. And so hopefully this one, I really loved working with the University of Arkansas Press, but I would like to see how it feels to go the traditional route.
Well, I'm talking to Sandaria Fay. Her debut novel is Mourner's Bench. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Sandaria, we are drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, I want to ask you if you have any writing advice for the writers listening.
I learned this at the MFA program and at Arizona State, and almost every professor that I had, Alberto Rios, Melissa Pritchard, Ron Carson, every time I would turn in a piece, they would say, keep writing. And that would be the advice that I would have for them, to keep writing. Even Ron Carson has it in his book, to keep your butt in the chair. And if you do that, and don't lose confidence. I've seen some MFA students who have way too much confidence, but you should have a lot more than what I have. Don't doubt yourself as much as I did. And just keep writing. And even with all of that, if you keep writing, you'll finish and you'll publish. If it's for you to publish, you'll publish. They also said don't worry about publishing, and I didn't. And see what happened. I really didn't have to worry about that.
Well, Sandaria, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun. I appreciate it so much. Mm.
That was author Sandaria Fay. Her new novel, Mourner's Bench, is out and published by University of Arkansas Press. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned for Positive Vibrations with Sister Rue coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks for joining us. Have a great day.